State of the Union.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes, and at this very moment, President Barack Obama and his speechwriters have just put the finishing touches on what will be the President's fifth State of the Union address. The House of Representatives will begin filling shortly with members of both houses and both parties, along with invited dignitaries, military officials, members of the Supreme Court, and ordinary citizens who have been asked to attend. Members of all three branches of government convene on this night at a time when the worst year of violent, terrifying war and spiraling financial chaos are behind us, but at a moment of historic levels of political polarization, when a majority of the nation's citizens view us as on the wrong track, with trust in Congress, not to mention nearly all of America's core institutions at or near historic lows. The president approaches the podium on this night to address a populace that remains restless, frustrated, a nation in which too many Americans remain out of work for too long, where wages are stagnating or declining, where many are in poverty, and a society that is being stretched to its breaking point as a smaller and smaller few manage to capture more and more of the nation's impossible bounty. So tonight, when the president speaks to what he calls the defining issue of our time, the distribution of wealth and power in this great republic of ours, remember, it was countless ordinary workers taking huge risks against daunting odds that brought us to this moment.
Tonight, let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. 1 year ago, in the State of the Union address, President Obama called on Congress to vote on a federal minimum wage increase for the first time in 7 years. But Republicans were not going to let that happen.
Raising the minimum wage does not grow the middle class.
It actually is counterproductive in many ways.
You raise the price of employment, you get less of it.
So, in the face of Republican obstruction, with no raise, minimum wage workers took their fate into their own hands. It was just 15 months ago that a few hundred brave people risked their livelihood, walking out of their minimum wage jobs in New York City, hoping someone would notice. 5 months later, the strike doubled in size, and we took notice.
I have to provide myself with food, clothes, a roof over my head. I don't have enough to even survive for the basic necessities of my household.
That was just the beginning. In July, over 2,000 people walked off the job calling for higher wages. By August, the protests exploded in more than 60 cities across the country. All of a sudden, minimum wage was national news.
In nearly 60 cities across the country today, fast food workers walked off the job.
Workers at fast food restaurants across the country are walking off the job today.
Workers say they can't afford to live on what they're getting paid.
Sometimes you have to yawn so much and beat, because sometimes you have to make a little noise.
After their largest strike yet, one thing became clear. The fast food giants had no interest in raising wages, but organizers turned their attention to the president.
There are about 2 million workers who work for federal contractors, $7.5, $14 grand a year. No benefits. An executive order could solve this problem.
Meanwhile, people kept on striking. In December, workers walked out in some 100 cities. This past week, Pentagon fast food workers walked off the job. And tonight, fast food worker and mother will be at the State of the Union to hear the president announce that he will issue an executive order to raise the minimum wage for federal contract workers. For the thousands of workers who have organized and fought over the last year, they have forced their voices to be heard.
Joining me now, Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat from Ohio. And Senator, I feel like your voters, your constituents in Ohio, are such a kind of weather vane for the American populace. Your state has been very hard hit by the loss of manufacturing. It's eased the way the economy is working firsthand. What do you think the voters of Ohio are looking for in terms of the performance of this economy and what the president says tonight?
Well, the voters of Ohio understand two things. They understand that the minimum wage, the value of the minimum wage, the purchasing power, is a third less than it was in 1968. They understand that minimum wage increases, as the last one in 2007, are bipartisan, and I think they wonder, why can't we pass a minimum wage? Why can't we work together on this?
bring the minimum wage at least to $10.10 an hour, raise the tip minimum wage from a 20 years it's been stuck at $2.13, raise that to $7 an hour over the next couple, 3 years. It will make a huge difference in people's lives. And Ohio voters understand one other thing, and that is that it's good for the economy. It puts money in people's pockets. It helps small business. It helps the economy grow.
We are looking at a live shot there, Senator, of Statuary Hall, right outside the Capitol. The point you just made there, I think, is an important one to stress. The tipped minimum wage has been at $2.13 for 20 years, a testament to the power of the restaurant lobby, I would add. And speaking of lobbies and obstruction and opposition to the president, the biggest thing I think between last year and this year's State of the Union are two kind of breaking points, the shutdown and the disastrous political consequences for Republicans, and the nuclear option on presidential nominees. Do you think this White House has a different approach now to Republican obstruction and a Republican House than it did a year ago?
Well, I think the White House understands finally that if it's not Barack Obama's name on it, the Republicans aren't interested, or they're interested in opposing it, and it's the same saw over and over again. Something happened, Chris. 100 years ago, this month, Henry Ford announced he was going to pay his workers $5 a day, not because he was good-hearted. History doesn't really say that about Henry Ford.
He did it because he understood it was good for the economy. It would help people grow. It would help people basically buy his cars. And the minimum wage plays the same role. You put money in the economy. Republicans are starting to hear that from voters around Ohio. They're starting to hear from minimum wage workers. There's a million people in Ohio that make less than $10 an hour. And this is life-changing for a number of them. It's not good enough, but it's so much better than what we have now. It's time we do this bipartisanly like we did 6 or 7 years ago.
And finally, Senator, it feels to me sometimes like, you know, the president is trying to turn a huge ship around. When you think about the trends of inequality, the policies of inequality, things that have been happening to push us towards this very unequal economy that you have, do you think it's hard to be able to go and tell voters we're going to change things when the distance between what you want and what ends up in their paycheck is so far?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what the president's trying to do has been blocked.
It just almost doesn't matter what it is. As you point out, appointments, minimum wage, extending unemployment benefits, immigration,
all the things that will help this economy grow, we haven't been able to do infrastructure, the kind of it. We haven't invested this little in years in our country. It's time we do.
Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, always a pleasure.
Thank
you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, joining me now, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Democrat from California, co-founder and co-chair of the Congressional Out of Poverty Caucus. And Congresswoman, there was a long time, particularly in the 1990s and even the early 2000s, there was a vigorous debate inside the Democratic Party about economic populism, about what kind of economic message Democrats needed to pursue as a matter of policy and as good politics. Do you feel that your portion of the Democratic Party, your argument, has won?
Well, I tell you, Chris, at this point, it's not about winning, but it's about embracing the debate and understanding that we need to move forward and address income inequality and the reduction and the elimination of poverty. I believe that our party, Democrats, really get it in terms of being on the side of the American people. When you look at the fact that we're trying to extend unemployment compensation right now as we speak for 1.4 million people, who's trying to do that? It's Democrats. We can't get the Republicans, especially here in the House, to support an extension of unemployment compensation. When you look at raising the minimum wage, for example, when you look at every issue that Senator Brown talked about, the president has been stopped each and every step of the way. And so I'm very pleased that the president is saying we can't wait now and that he's going to do everything he can do to take executive action to make sure that the American people have a shot at the American dream.
Well, what do you say to those, I've seen John Boehner, Republicans, and others crying about this being an imperial presidency, this ignoring the Constitution, pushing for executive orders. What's your response to that?
My response is they're just wrong. This is a democracy. And when you go back to when President Obama was elected, he tried every which way to get Republicans to support the Recovery Act. It ended up being much too low for many of us, $780 billion. We wanted over $1 trillion because we knew that would happen. But, of course, the White House, in the spirit of compromise, negotiated with the Republicans, not one Republican vote. When you look at the Affordable Care Act, universal, accessible, affordable care for every American, the president worked with Republicans. How many votes did he get? Not one Republican vote. And so it's time now to take executive action. The Democrats are fully in support of that, and I'm very proud of what the president is going to say tonight. We need to address income inequality, and we reassure the American people that we're on their side. When you look at $7.25 an hour, how can anyone survive off of that? When you look at the fact that the taxpayer subsidizes big corporations to the tune of $243 billion and urges their employees to apply for food stamps and Medicaid and Section 8, come on, Chris, it's about time that stops.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Joining me now, Heather McGee, soon to be president of the progressive think tank, Demos. Heather, congratulations on your new post. It's wonderful news for the country, for the progressive movement. We're all very happy about this. And the reason I wanted you on was to take a victory lap, because tonight the president is going to sign an executive order raising the minimum wage for workers who are working for federal contractors. And the idea for that started with this report by a little think tank called Demos, which was titled Underwriting Bad Jobs, How Our Tax Dollars Are Funding Low-Wage Work and Fueling Inequality. This came from your shop.
This research came from our shop. I have to say that their success has many mothers. The most important thing is actually what you highlighted beautifully in your reel, the fact that people who are actually, for whom a day's pay means a lot, actually stepped away from that day's pay to strike. There's been research about this issue for about a decade. EPI has done this as well as our friends at NELP, because this seems like such a no-brainer.
Right.
The American taxpayer, if you combine up all the different ways that our federal dollars are touching these low-wage service employees between grants and loans and all of that, it's $2.2 million. That's more than McDonald's and Walmart combined. So there was an idea about trying to really push the research case for this and say, you know what, we know that Congress isn't going to do anything about the minimum wage because it's so captured, frankly, by the donor class and the corporate lobby you talked about, but the president is sort of the big boss, right? And he can do it. He can be the responsible employer that he wants the whole country to be.
The president will announce he will use executive authority to raise minimum wage to $10.10 for those working on new federal contracts for services, I'm reading off a White House statement. Raising wages for those at the bottom will improve the quality and efficiency of services provided to the government. This will not touch all 2 million. It's unclear how far in terms of the numbers of people we're going to see. Do you think this also has cascade effects in terms of the labor market more broadly, or just the conversation about the minimum wage?
I think it's a conversation not only about the minimum wage, but about what's wrong with our economy, right? If the president is able to say that the problem with our economy is not, in fact, that there are too many regulations or too low taxes on the wealthy, right, which is all we're hearing from the right, but saying, you know what, here's what progressives say, here's what Democrats say, that if you are a responsible employer, this is what you do. It is better for productivity. It's better for the economy as a whole. I think the president is going to be at Costco tomorrow. We do a lot of research at Demos about the retail sector, which is one of those large, one of the fastest growing sectors in the economy, and one where it is proven that if you have better paid workers and lower turnover, better customer service and sales.
You know, it's fascinating because I think that one of the other useful things about this is that it's a proof of concept. And we've
Absolutely.
Seen in local municipal elections and state elections, they raise minimum wage, and actually you don't see some massive hit to the employment level. And also there is something for the economists out there. There's an efficiency wage. There's some good evidence to suggest when you pay your workers at the bottom of the wage scale more, actually get a more productive, longer-lasting workforce, less prone to turnover, less money spent training. Heather McGee, soon to be new president of Demos. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
All right, coming up, our special all-in State of the Union coverage continues. Do not go anywhere. We will have Rachel Maddow and Chris Maddow.
You are listening to the Pinkney the Pinkney Show. We are going to hear Obama, State of the Union. You people out there who believe in your president, you get a chance today. You get a chance today to listen to his genius, State of the Union. We are right in the middle of a real situation here. We're going to find out exactly what the president is going to say and how he's going to say it. We need people to listen and to give us feedback on this. Everybody will have an opportunity to talk and speak in reference to this thing. So those of you out there, stay tuned. Do not leave us. Just listen to what Obama. I know that you're going to love it. Because those are people out there who really like this man, even though he has done nothing for our community, for our people, But he's still here. He's your president. He's president of these United States. So stay tuned, and let's wait for our next guest. God bless you. Just hang in there. We'll be listening to Obama's speech starting at 9:01. But in the meantime, we'll be listening to other people talk about what Obama is doing. So stay with us. Don't leave us. Hang in there.
I'm going to take my pen and I'm going to start to order things to happen. And the first thing is going to be going to raise the minimum wage for federal workers and contracts, which is about, you know, 17 people. It's nothing. But he's going to do kind of the macho bluster thing, saying, "Look, you guys are pinheads. I'm going around you." How do you think that's going to play? You know, again, I just tell you, in West Virginia, we want him to be the president of all of us, not just certain segments of society, certain partisan, and that's not the way to do it. You don't go it alone. We're all in this together. The Constitution is very clear. We have the responsibility. As an executive, I was governor of the state of West Virginia. I was responsible for the day-to-day operations, but I could not do, nor should I do, the policies for the state of West Virginia. I needed the legislature to help do that and approve of it because they represented the people. He has the same responsibility. So whether you're Democrat or Republican, Mr. President, we want you to be the president of all of us and work with all of us.
I don't know if we're going to hear that tonight, though.
I'm hoping for that.
All right. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us tonight.
Directly ahead, Senator Chuck Schumer, a whole different kind of Democrat than Senator Manchin. Now, Senator Schumer wants the IRS to continue to scrutinize the Tea Party. Very controversial. He'll be here later. Real-life exorcism story that Indiana police are taking very seriously. Is it legal? Has been investigating. And we'll have that story up ahead.
Investigate whether or not the project will be done in a timely fashion and within budget.
Join Angie's List for all kinds of reasons.
In town.
Google reviews on everything from home repair to health care.
Now that we're expecting investigators found when they discovered Darlene Haynes, 23, who had been so brutally killed, how much of an effect do you think, Dr. Moroney, that's going to have on the jury and also all the evidence there, too?
Well, the evidence is insurmountable, but we have to go back to the fundamentals. Everybody keeps worrying about DNA. There's patterns of fiber and trace transfer. Fingerprints are also important, but sometimes they're just considered old-fashioned. You cannot have that much of a messy, disturbed crime scene without bloody fingerprints, and those are the kind of things that are going to have to come out slowly, but that photographic evidence is traumatic. And if you remember, there are some people like Drew Peterson in Chicago. He's in jail because of the violent nature of what happened, and there was no victim to be found. So juries do look at the tragedy of the forensic evidence, and that will be very important. Yeah.
Let's go to the defense attorneys, Randy Tesler, Michael Gottlieb. The other thing, too, is today there was a DNA expert who said, yeah, the baby that this woman suddenly shows up with and says, oh, I had a baby. Meanwhile, there's no proof she had a baby anywhere. No hospital shows she had a baby. She calls a friend, calls a boyfriend, too, and says, oh, my water broke, and then I had a baby girl. It's confirmed that it's this woman who was murdered, whose body we see laying there, that it's her baby. So what's the defense, Randy Kessler, for this one?
Well, it's a tragedy, but, you know, we have the right to a trial by jury, and that's what Jodi Arias did. We see where that ended up landing her, but she wanted to defend herself, and this lady apparently thinks there's some sympathy in the jury. The problem is...
You know what's amazing, Randy? Randy, she said she got the baby by legal means. And then the other thing we heard in the last 24 hours, she's saying, oh, so-and-so did it, so-and-so may have done it, you know, the boogeyman may have done it. The jury's going to go, wait a minute. You made all these calls. Your fingerprint is on the wine cooler, which is in the house. People saw her with the woman the night she was killed. All right. This evidence, what, suddenly a baby just happens to spring out of nowhere? She has to explain how she, quote, got it for legal means, don't you think, Randy?
Yes, but you know what, Rita? You can't be found not guilty if you plead guilty. She pled not guilty. It still gives her a chance of being not guilty. You're innocent until proven guilty. So right now, she's innocent. She may be delaying the inevitable, But right now, you never know. Prosecutions make mistakes. They drag cases out. They make errors. They make you put on gloves that don't fit, and then you have to acquit.
Yeah, she just kind of happens to have the baby, Randy. Just happens to have the baby.
I'm not saying she's innocent. I'm saying she may have a defense, and she's trying her case, and she has the right to a trial by jury. If she's found guilty, she will pay the consequences, but she has the right to a defense.
Wow, amazing. Who would believe that? A young lady. I tell you, we are in for a shock now. Let's listen to some Obama.
The ball, but the main thing is he will frame the argument in the way I believe the American people are seeing it. And what's interesting to me, Chris, is how much this argument has shifted, because now you see even Republicans acknowledging that, yes, this is a big challenge. Now, their prescriptions are completely different. I don't think they're particularly helpful. But the fact that Marco Rubio and Eric Cantor and others are now talking about this as a central challenge tells you how much public opinion is beginning to catch up with the politicians in Washington.
We are awaiting the president leaving the White House for the speech there on your screen. That's where we expect to see him leave momentarily. Washington Post has a poll about which party is closer to your view on the minimum wage. Democrats 49%, Republicans 35%. So, David, I think you're right on the minimum wage. Do you think there is a danger in telling a story about income inequality that ends up putting the blame on the American people for not getting enough skills? I hear this sometimes from certain people around the president. I've heard it from the president himself, in which it sounds like part of what he's saying is the American people need to get better educated. I'm not sure that's actually the full problem.
Well, it's not the full problem, but it is an element of the problem. There are millions of jobs that are available and others that are emerging that require skills that people don't have now, and if they had them, they could fill those jobs. And so creating these synergies between community colleges and businesses and so on. Excuse me? Creating synergies between community colleges and businesses, creating these high-tech corridors and so on. All of these things are useful in terms of creating good, well-paying, middle-class jobs, and we have to reform our job training system to make sure people have those skills.
MSNBC senior political analyst, former White House advisor, David Axelrod. Thanks for your time tonight, David. All right, coming up, our special all-in State of the Union coverage continues. We'll have live pictures from the Capitol. We're awaiting President Obama's big speech, and Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews will be here to preview with us. Stay with us.
On the social, what is social welfare?
And in fact, the IRS used to say that if you spent more than 50% of your money on ads, that was not social welfare.
Here's the deal.
I got a lot of stuff to get to you with. Social welfare, I know you'd agree with me. It's subjective. And so the Supreme Court can never really define it. Well, I'm on your side on this thing. I think it's being abused by both sides, but I don't think you pointed that out strongly enough. That's my beef with you, right? I don't want rich guys, all right? Like what happened? Do you know how much Priorities USA spent defaming Mitt Romney in the last election? Do you know how much? Hey, I don't know the number, but it was $57 million. If they did it under the 501c4, they ought to be shut down. I'll say it right here. Liberal group, pro-democratic group, shut them down. You and I agree on this issue, but I want you to be fair and balanced when you specifically name a group. That's all I'm asking. That's why I'm here on Fox News. All right. Be fair and balanced. Okay. Now, you know I'm going into the White House to talk to your pal, your best friend, President Obama. Okay? Yes. Number one, what's the biggest mistake, and I asked this to the other two senators before you, what is the biggest mistake, you've been around a long time, that President Obama has made? This is, I said this at the same speech. The biggest mistake he made, and I think the biggest mistake we Democrats made, was when in 2010 the new folks came in, Tea Party and everyone else, and attacked government as the root of all evil, we should have given a more robust defense of government. The bottom line is there There are lots of problems that were not created by government. The biggest one is loss of middle class incomes, loss of good paying jobs, which was created by technology and globalization. Above all, when you can move a job to China or India, it reduces wages. And in our view, government, good education programs, building infrastructure, doing scientific research is the answer, the antidote. But we let
you wanted to fight more for the big government, and you don't think you did enough on that.
I wouldn't call it big government, but I would say when they came in and said government's the root of all evil and never the solution, we should have said many of the problems are not caused by government, and government is the solution.
Okay,
absolutely.
Now, give me one question that Schumer wants me to ask Obama.
Give me who you're rooting for. At the Super Bowl, who you're rooting for.
Come on, you want it to be a softball, Patty, cute, and cupcake interview? Is that what you want?
Of course. But if you're not going to do that, I would ask them, what can he do? Assuming Congress won't do anything to raise middle class.
Jobs, that's what you wanted to ask.
Create jobs and raise middle class incomes, because even people with jobs are finding their purchasing power is declining.
Well, of course, under the Obama administration, it's declined $5,000 per family median income.
It was declined under Bush, even
not that much.
Oh, accelerating. It's not a government. Government didn't cause this problem. Americans know that. Technology, it's globalization. What do we do to counter it?
We appreciate you coming on tonight. Plenty more ahead.
Factor moves along.
Charles Krauthammer has some thoughts on the State of the Union, and he will state them.
Said a sensational story that Is It Legal is investigating possible exorcism situation in Indiana. Cops are taking it very seriously. You have to stay tuned for those reports.
Look. In recent years, the quickest way to go from rising Republican star to former rising Republican star is to deliver the response to the president's annual address to Congress.
Americans can't do anything.
For Republicans looking to make their mark, the hope is that the American people will remember them for their ideas and rhetoric. But more likely, they will be remembered for stagecraft.
In the short time that I've been here in Washington, nothing has frustrated me more than false choices like the one the president laid out tonight.
Note to future responders, it is important to hydrate before giving a televised response. Also, important to look into the right camera.
The Tea Party is a dynamic force for good in our national conversation, and it's an honor for me to speak with you.
Even if the response itself doesn't kill one's political ambition, it does serve as a reminder that the GOP sure does know how to pick them.
Good evening. I'm Bob McDonald. I come before you this evening as someone who has been falsely and wrongfully accused.
This year, the Republican Party will be offering four different responses, at least. First, there's the official response. That honor goes to Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers. Given her party's struggle with connecting to female voters, it is important to note that McMorris Rogers is, in fact, female, the highest-ranking Republican woman in the House. Next, there is the official response in Spanish. That will be delivered by Congresswoman Ileana Roth Lee. Then there is the Tea Party response. That will be given by Senator Mike Lee, the cagney to Ted Cruz's Lacey.
Don't you ever question my motives.
New this year, the response from Rand Paul of the Rand Paul Party. Mr. Paul will be offering his own freelance video message to be posted on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Snapchat. But if you aren't satisfied with the official response, La Respuesta Oficial en Español, the Tea Party response, or the Rand Paul response, fear not. The GOP will have rapid response booths set up just outside the House chamber, where any and all Republican lawmakers can give their own personalized response to the president's address through six-second Vine video. You get a response. You get a response. You get a response. Everybody gets a response. This messaging free-for-all is kind of like Time Magazine honoring you as the person of the year. If you are giving the response to the State of the Union, then, well, no one is giving the response to the State of the Union.
Coming up, our special all-in State of the Union coverage continues with Rachel Maddow, Chris Matthews, and
President's speech is just minutes away. Stay right there.
When does your work end? Does it end after you've expanded your business? After your company has gone public? And capital has been invested? And when your company has bought another? Is it over after you've given back? We never stop achieving. That's why at Barclays, our ambition is to always realize yours.
Because Staples has everything you need to launch your big idea. Adding thousands of products online every day, from hard hats and goggles, to tools and cleaning products, to state-of-the-art computers, to coffee to keep you fueled. From the sign over the door, to the boxes to get it out the door. Yes, Staples has everything you need to launch your big idea. Except your big idea. So when you get an idea, we're ready with everything else. Staples, make more happen.
In the nation, we know how you feel about your car. So when coverage really counts, count on Nationwide Insurance. Because it's precious to you, it's precious to us. That's another way to make numbers work. Because we don't have shareholders.
You can't at all.
I intentionally agree with this. However, I think her actual big regret should be twofold. Number one, her department denied multiple requests for additional security when that security situation was deteriorating.
Right.
Requests made by the ambassador serving under her when everybody knew that Benghazi was overrun with Al-Qaeda and other terrorists.
Personal security that was offered from another source. Okay, but what struck me, Colmes, was she's flat. You know, when talking about,
she didn't say it the way she should have.
Maybe. I didn't see a lot of empathy there. She can never make certain people happy, no matter what she does.
I think that's true.
I think she didn't say it right. The words weren't exactly right.
Did you see a lot of empathy there?
And then when she expressed regret. If she hadn't said it, you would have had a million conservatives say, why did you mention Benghazi? I mean, she can never make some people happy.
I agree with you that everything that she does is going to be criticized, just like Barack Obama, by some people.
That's true.
Now, my question for you, Colmes. Did Hillary Clinton, in your mind, ever do anything wrong? Did she ever do anything wrong?
Correct.
Well, all of us have done things
in the public arena, Colmes.
In the public arena.
Yes.
She was never the president. She's only held public office as a senator for a short time. I wouldn't say she's done anything wrong.
Nothing jumps out at you, Alan Colmes.
That's great.
Not one thing that you've ever seen in the public arena.
Don't make me happy.
I just want an honest opinion.
I think she was a good senator. She was a very good secretary of state.
I do not have an issue at the moment with Hillary.
Okay, I want to be clear
that in your experience, you're a New Yorker.
Okay.
That's correct.
And Mrs. Clinton has been in the public eye now.
I tell you what, I will come up for that. 25 years.
I don't think she should have. I don't like her support of the Iraq War. I think that was a mistake. I think it was a mistake that too many Democrats voted for the Iraq War.
It's a horrible mistake.
Anything else?
Well, it's the first thing that comes to mind.
I mean, that's a big one.
That's big.
Because I don't think we should have been about
it. I can give you a whopper.
No, I don't want one from you.
Here's
what I want from you.
Has Hillary Clinton never done anything right?
Oh, that's a very thought-provoking
question.
Yeah.
Give me one.
That's in my head. Something that she has done right.
Yeah, correct. Anything.
I can fill a volume with what she's done wrong.
Well, I pick another category.
This is what I mean.
Well, you're both partisan people.
Well,
that's why we have you on. We want to have a lively discussion. But you don't think critically about your
person.
And you're just looking to whack her a couple of times.
She's been so much wrong, mainly lying to the faces of the Benghazi, the fellows, and the four who died. She kept up this lie for weeks on end that it was a spontaneous demonstration as a result of the video. That, to me, overwhelmed everything. And even if I could come up with something positive that she has done, the fact that she oversaw this horrendous event, that, by the way, she used the word tragedy. It is a tragedy for the families of those four, but for the nation, it was an act of war. This was an act of terrorism against the United States. She should be talking about it.
That's an absurd reaction to Hillary Clinton.
It did not lie. Benghazi is not a scandal. Benghazi is a tragedy.
since her election. It didn't unseat Barack Obama, and it's not going to hurt Hillary Clinton. It is a
why now is she engaging in this kind of preemptive language? Because
I think it's a very smart way to do it, because she knows that people are human, she sees the cases out of her for the next 4 years.
Everything she does is very strategic. So what she's starting to do now, especially with Benghazi, with what you just saw, Bill, was this idea that she can put out there, she's addressed it, she's taken responsibility, whatever the hell that means, and now she can say, it's in the past, it's old news. So when it comes up in 2015 and 2016, she can say, I already dealt with that. This is what the Clintons do, they do it very well, but you got to stay on it because this thing keeps unfolding.
Yeah, it's old news. It's already old news. She's running, right, Bill? Yeah. She's running.
Of course she is.
All right. So at least we all agree on that. We agree on one thing, everyone. I am the master diplomat right here. On deck, it looks like there's a real-life exorcism going on in Indiana. And the former mayor of New Orleans who presided over Hurricane Katrina on trial for corruption, legal, is next.
Welcome to Vegas.
Douglas, De Niro, Freeman, Clyde.
We're going to party like it's 1959.
Are you good in that?
I don't remember.
Wow!
Last figures. Now, on to a couple back.
This is interesting. It says here that a woman's sex drive increases at the age of 80.
How to produce the rest of my children.
It seems to be...
Yeah, this is good as I tell them. Mm-hmm. Then you're gonna have the white
voters
come on in too now.
They don't. Right, but can you convince those people that's true? Because I don't think they believe it. They really.
Well, they're beginning to. I mean, you hear not only Warren Buffett and Bill Gates Sr. You hear Bill Gross, the head of PIMCO, the giant bond trading firm, and all these people are starting to look at the economy and they're starting to say, wait a minute, there's something fundamental wrong here. We're not going to make money if the vast American middle class and the poor don't have any money in their pockets. The customers are driving the economy, or should be driving the economy. They are the job creators. It's dawning on them.
Slowly but surely, it is dawning on you. You should look at some of the earnings analysis come out of Wall Street for firms like Walmart, which basically say, look, if people don't have money to spend, the stock price of your enterprise is in trouble. Former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, Rachel Maddow and Chris Matthews will be here with me as the president makes his way down Pennsylvania Avenue to deliver his State of the Union speech. That is just minutes away. Don't go away.
You're watching MSNBC. As President Trump has said,
No question about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely going to stay home and make sure that people see exactly what's going on.
Drive in the Congress on this day.
The Supreme Court are walking by right now for those watching at home and seeing these august individuals. Here is Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Good to see you. And we saw the Chief Justice John Roberts walk by just a few minutes ago. Here is Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan and other justices of the court walking by. Of course, they sit in the chamber. They tend to not react. They tend to not stand up and applaud and cheer. In fact, Justice Antonin Scalia has voiced concern about going to the State of the Union addresses in the past because he says it feels more like a pep rally. Dan, I'm sorry. Go back to you. Please continue.
No, you know, it makes what I'm about to describe even more surreal and bizarre because what I'm looking at right now is Willie Robertson, one of the stars of Duck Dynasty, and he is here as a guest.
I'm sorry to interrupt your discussing one of the stars of Duck Dynasty, but I do have the Vice President and the Senate and the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid. Vice President Biden, good to see you. Leader Reid, how are you? Good to see you, sir. Mr. Durbin, how are you doing? Good to see you. Mr. Bennett. We have all the senators coming in now. This is now you know that we're really getting serious. Supreme Court justices, members of the Senate, things are getting serious here. But Dan, I'm sorry, you were talking about one of the stars of Duck Dynasty.
And I'm emphasizing this not because, you know, I think it's necessarily important, but because I want to set the scene for what's happening, and that he is here, Willie Robertson, not just to be sitting in the gallery, but I have seen a steady stream of congressmen make their way up the stairs, up the gallery, to come and greet him, to take pictures with him. So you're sitting there with members of the Supreme Court, the Majority Leader, the Vice President, and a lot of members are just interested in coming and taking a picture with somebody who's a star of Duck Dynasty. It is definitely something that I have not seen in my many, many years of covering the State of the Union addresses.
No, that's right. It's interesting. This year we have, as we've mentioned before, special guests. Hey, Senator Portman, how are you? We have had special guests of the president since 1982. Hey, Senator Casey, how are you doing? Senator Booker, Cory Booker of New Jersey, pride of New Jersey, Senator Hayes. Oh, yeah, there you go. How are you doing? Good to see you, Senator Blumenthal. We have these, what are called the Lenny Skutniks, the people that the president brings in, the heroes. But this year we also have members of the House Republican Party bringing individuals like Sean Hannity, Reagan economist Art Laffer, one of the fathers of one of the Navy SEALs, Clayton and Benghazi, Tyrone Woods, and then, of course, as you mentioned, Willie Robertson, Dan Abash. Well, I don't recall that tradition ever happening before, but it seems to be new this year.
So there's always new traditions that start developing. We're going to see the speaker momentarily. He's going to call the House to order, Jake, as the senators come in, you see the vice president there in the middle of the screen together with Harry Reid, the majority leader. They're all just chatting amongst themselves as they get ready for the introduction of others who are going to be coming in, including members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Supreme Court justices, the diplomatic corps. They will be coming in at some point. Sergeant of Arms will introduce, of course, the President of the United States. By the way, the First Lady will be escorted into the gallery called the Executive Gallery. But there you see the Vice President. He was a member of the Senate for more than three decades, so he knows he's very, very familiar with this tradition. He used to sit there as a senator, but now he'll be sitting behind the President of the United States for the President's fifth State of the Union. This is the eighth time, by the way, the President has addressed a joint session of Congress. Secretary Reid, the Majority Leader. There you see the House Chamber, the President's motorcade is about to arrive. The President and the First Lady, they made that short trip from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue up Pennsylvania Avenue to Capitol Hill. Now they're arriving. When the President travels, it's not just one or two cars. It's a whole bunch of cars, a lot of motorcycles. They make that quick trip up from the White House to Capitol Hill, and there we see that motorcade arriving right now. Once the President and here, he'll go upstairs, gets himself ready. He's got his speech. He's been preparing for this flight for a long time. President knows this is a very, very important opportunity for him, not only to address the members of the House and the Senate, but also to address the the American public, and in fact, the international community. People are going to be watching all over the world, and there will be a significant portion of the President's speech devoted to several key international issues, including Afghanistan, including Iran, including what's happening in Syria and elsewhere. There is the Vice President and the Speaker, John Boehner. He's about to gavel this session into order. The Speaker was saying earlier in the day, saying the President should be very, very careful with these executive orders. He said if he tries to ignore the will of the Congress, in Boehner's words, he's going to run into a, quote, brick wall. So there will be some tension. There's no doubt about it. But there is some collegiality as these senators are walking in. They just see some of the senators, John Cornyn of Texas, and there's the Senator Roy Flex on the screen over there. That's not going to work. I want you to help pick up some of the
crap. It's interesting to me how Jake Tapper has become the maitre d' on Capitol Hill. I feel like he's taking drink orders. That's the next step. People flipping his tip. I don't know how he got that location. The weirdest thing I've seen tonight, we're back with their panelists, their Sean Kingler, Borger, John Stavro from Barack Obama's federal government.
For those candidates seeking re-election, for particularly for the Senate in 2014, there's a number of people, high-profile races. Is this president going to be out? Is
Do they want him campaigning for them?
No, he's already gone into a few states where they have not been a scheduling conflict.
So how does that impact tonight and what he has to say?
Well, this is a split among Democrats. When the president's talking about income inequality, most of those Democrats will be happy to hear that. They believe if you campaign thematically on jobs, that will all of them going to vote for exactly what the president wants, maybe not. But they think economic inequality, fighting for jobs, that helps them. The fact that Jim Acosta supported the president's open to signing some changes on Obamacare, that will help them, because the most interesting thing is the Republicans are going to step back. You know, the Republicans want to repeal Obamacare, they don't like Obamacare, but they're going to step back and let the Democrats complain. Let the Marylanders, let the Mark Pryors, let the Mark Begich, three Democratic senators vote. Let them come forward and say we have to change Obamacare, and then try to go beyond what they want. But if the Republicans handle this correctly, they want the Democrats to put the pressure on the president. The question tonight is, can the president, the main thing is, watch the 43. Is that 43% approval? If he can get that 48, 49, Democrats will suddenly be more friendly. If it stays down in the low 40s, then they're going
to
walk away.
The messaging tonight, in terms of what he has to say, does he do something to try to help those candidates, even those who don't want him out there campaigning for him?
I think issues like the minimum wage are so broadly popular in the public. You know, they pull very, very high, and I think the Democrats are back.
And the Democratic base.
And the Democratic base. But I suggest the Democrats who, you know, it's a very popular issue.
But I think the most interesting thing will be what he does or does not say about health care reform. Because people are bad for not being able to keep the plan that they like. They're not being able to go to the doctor that they like. And a lot of Democratic Senate incumbents are very nervous about that.
Well, but the majority of people still say now, keep it and fix it. They don't want to get rid of it at this point.
I want to bring in Dana Bash, who's watching the scene there. Dana, here's your vantage point. What are you seeing? What are you seeing?
Well, as you just saw from Jake's made-to-be, all the senators are now here on the House floor, so they're all milling around greeting their brethren in the House. One thing I am noticing is, remember a couple of years ago, a tradition started for members of both parties to come kind of esteemed. And that is now continuing unofficially. For example, I'm looking down and I see John McCain, Senator from Arizona, Republican, who walked in with Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat from New York. So they're sort of doing it on their own, even though there's no real formal decision to approve this in a bipartisan way, because historically what we have seen is Democrats sitting on one side, Republicans on the other. So you saw when the president said, a Democratic president said something Democrats like, one side stood up and vice versa.
Okay.
And I think it looks different now.
Dana, will Jake Tapper be the one actually announcing the arrival of the President of the United States tonight? Has he now taken on that role as well?
I would not put anything past our Jake Tapper. It's entirely possible.
It's interesting, Dana, also, I mean, for those people who don't know, and we mentioned this a little bit earlier, there are members of Congress who spend, I mean, 5, 6, 7 hours just trying to reserve a seat on the aisle so they can kind of grip and grin the President of the United States as he passes by.
Absolutely. It is a tradition that we've seen for years and years.
And I guess the question is, do they not have anything better to do today? I mean...
Well, I've actually done stories on some of these congressmen, like Elliot Engel from New York. He does have better things to do, and he kind of does his work. He sets up shots on the House floor. They're not supposed to do this, Anderson. They are told, you know, you're not allowed to save seats, but they do it anyway. And someone like Elliot Engel, for example, he told me he's been here for decades representing his district in New York, and he says that he hears more from his constituents that they saw him shaking the president's hand, whether it was George Bush or Barack Obama, than anything else he does. So, you know, maybe it's worth the hours. But it's not just 7, 8 hours. Sometimes it's like 12 to 15 hours that they set up shop.
They actually spend 15 hours?
Sometimes even longer. I heard an unsubstantiated report that there was one member who came last night.
Wow.
People spent longer waiting for an iPhone, though.
Did they get to the bathroom? I mean, what happens?
Yes, they can. It's not like a filibuster.
Okay.
They can get up and walk.
They're allowed to walk. Let's take a
50.
There's the guy from Duck Dynasty. We're joined by also the Crossfire crowd. You know, before we went away, SE had said that we were talking about immigration reform. I think you wanted to respond.
Oh, well, I mean, I said it was like a ball cocktail being thrown into the middle of the room. Here's reality.
this president has gone above and beyond the call of duty. Every speech he reaches out, he tries to make common cause. And unfortunately, you have a part of the Republican Party, the Tea Party, that has decided from the very beginning they were never going to work with him. And so I think people who are Democrats and people who are independent are actually proud of this president. He is not the prime minister. He doesn't have to govern only through the legislature. The president of the United States, we have three co-equal branches. And he should be doing everything he can to help this country. And he is going to do that. I think he's going to start up to do it.
Other than the fact, until 2 days ago, I couldn't convince Sam that the Chicago Bears were not going to win the Super Bowl. And he's not much more effective reality here. But actually, the fact is, if this president has this power, what is dereliction to do? He said 5 years to do all these things.
Well,
if he's got that much power,
unfortunately, he was busy saving the economy. He was busy saving the auto industry. He was busy writing down two wars. And he had other things too,
and now he's going to continue to do other good things for us. I find it interesting that you are defending the productivity of the Congress. I think you stand alone in this country in defending that. And I also think that you know, we're all aware of the president's user of executive authority all the time. In fact, in President Clinton's second term, when you were Speaker, when things weren't getting through Congress, he used his executive authority all the time to continue doing the country forward.
So
that's
so
what the president is talking about tonight. If Congress won't act, I will. But we can be stronger when we're together and making these actions.
I don't object to the president being presidential. Ronald Reagan came in, and he did a whole bunch of executive orders the first year. I just think it's amazing that in the fifth year, suddenly Obama jumped up and goes, I have a pen. What did he think he had the first 4 years?
There's plenty of executive action.
So look,
over the first last 5 years. What how we fixed the Dream Act, that young kids came here.
Oh, by executive order. But look, I love you, man. You know I do.
But are you serious?
Yes.
Remember the State of the Union where the president scolded the Supreme Court in front of them? This president has not gone above and beyond to harmoniously bring the Congress or the country together. He's taken opportunities to divide the country. He's going to do it again tonight.
Let's
a polling show.
Let me bring the other panel over here. In terms of his relations with Congress, do you think he has made inroads?
Well, a couple of times.
Relations with Congress, the president, that I can recall in my lifetime. He doesn't get along with Democrats. He doesn't socialize with them. He doesn't reach out to them. He doesn't invite them to work with him. He has tried of late. He has done more of it. And he has said he's the father of two young children. In the first term, he put his priority on that. He spent less time with Congress. They have done more socializing of late. Should it matter? Probably not. People should do their jobs, but they're not their buddy-buddy. Has it mattered historically in Washington? Yes. Does it matter when you have very difficult issues, as Speaker Gingrich was saying? When President Clinton, you're sparring over a lot of things, even impeachment, but you make a few jokes, you build a relationship, it helps. It helps you.
You are listening to the Pinckney to Pinckney Show. I am the Reverend Edward Pinckney. We're waiting for your president to come. 7 minutes. 7 minutes before the State of the Union. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Pinckney to Pinckney Show. I am the Reverend Edward Pinckney.
But I'm going to take this great compromise that people have put in front of me.
You know, I think every president develops at a certain point a certain amount of disdain for Congress. Whether you have it when you come in or you have it on the way out, the relationship gets frayed. There's no doubt about
even
it.
Even when you were one of them before.
Even when you were one of them before. So you, but I think with President Obama, the problem has been that lots of members of Congress believe that he had it when he was in Congress. And that's why he left the Senate, because he wanted to be president, and the Senate wasn't good enough, and there's a sense he never liked him very much.
Has written a huge number of speeches for this president and looked over the speech tonight. What do you watch when you watch a speech tonight? I mean, what is going to be in your mind for things to look for that maybe our viewers...
I mean, I actually think, I would not say that he has been a defiant tone. I think it's much more of a determined. I think that he feels reaching out to Congress wherever it's
pregnant.
And I think he actually made the case for his leadership and the fact that, you know, Republicans could come around on immigration reform.
The joint session will come to order.
Immigration reform bill. You have a farm bill.
The chair appoints members of the committee on the floor of the House to escort the President of the United States into the chamber. The gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Cantor. The gentleman from California, Mr. McCarthy. The gentleman from Oregon, Mr. Wolf. The gentleman from Oklahoma, Mr. Langford.
It's just a procedural.
Gentlewoman from Kansas, Ms. Jenkins. Gentlewoman from North Carolina, Ms. Fox.
There was a lot of angst about the law.
Gentlewoman from California, Ms. Pelosi.
You made a point.
The gentleman from Maryland
in calling for security and respect.
Gentleman from South Carolina, Ms. Weber.
Gentleman from California, Ms.
Sarah.
Actually, complimented his critics in Congress and said that some of the criticism had been constructive and his help. We've not heard that kind of rhetoric, I don't think, from President Obama. We certainly didn't hear it in the second inaugural.
No, I think he's trying to set his speech as responsibility. I think, unfortunately, it's the push you're calling for doesn't accept me. So, I mean, it's up to you. You expect tonight to hear him reaching out to... I think he'll definitely accept him. I know he will, and I think we're into both parties and really urge members of Congress to work with him wherever they can. I think we'll cite Republican ideas and Republicans who propose those ideas as models of working together in collaboration. So I think it'll be very similar to what... Does that matter, reaching out in a speech like this? I'm sure, in part because they're about to run campaign ads, you know, beating up the president, beating up his agenda. If he can position himself some way, then you seem more reasonable. You seem like the person in the bill. You seem like the person who wants to listen to everybody and make progress going forward. Of course you can help. I'm fascinated at moments like this, and both Johnny and Karen can give insight. Look, these guys, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they're competitive people. You don't get to be president of the United States without being a fiercely competitive person. And now you're at a low. When you're standing up there and you know you're at 42, 43, what is it like as a competitor to stand there, and President Obama's going to be looking out at some of his fiercest critics, but also the few friends he has in the Congress. That, to me, is how you step up to this moment and try to turn it into a moment of opportunity, to me, is the big chance. Mayor, we'll list the loss with that in mind. I want to go back to the world.
We're awaiting the First Lady of the United States. She'll be introduced. She'll go up to the gallery where she will have her own special invited guest. The escorts have now left, members of the House, members of the Senate. They'll be bringing the President of the United States into the chamber. The moment is getting closer for the President to deliver his State of the Union address. Jake Tapper standing right outside the House chamber. Jake?
Well, as you see right now, you see the Second Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, making her way into the chamber right now. Most of the dignitaries who are going to attend are already inside, where Dana Bash is, our chief congressional correspondent. Dana, what is the mood? What is the scene right now? It looks like a lot of people who haven't seen each other in a long time catching up.
It does. You know, at this point, everybody is sitting in their seats. The anticipation is much different. You can see it. Everybody standing and applauding as they're anticipating the president coming in. So many of these people have been here before, but one thing I want to point out is that for many of these House Republicans who the president has clashed with, they're relatively new. The majority of the House Republican caucus is relatively new, and that has shaped a lot of the atmosphere here. And it is, in the hopes of John Boehner, are going to be changing as people kind of settle in to understanding in his caucus how things work and how they need to be more on the offense, even though this today, on the offense on their issues and not so much the party of no.
That's right, and House Speaker John Boehner has talked about how he did not approve of the tactics to cause the government shutdown last year, but he let the caucus do what they wanted to do, and he hopes that they have learned their lesson in terms of tactics that work and tactics that don't work. Wolf Blitzer, this is one of the most challenging things for a House Speaker and a Vice President to do, is to stand be expressionless for an hour-plus speech as the President delivers the State of the Union every year.
Governor, at some point, Jake, as you know, you'll see the Vice President, he'll be applauding, the Speaker won't be applauding. At some point, you'll see the Speaker standing together with the Vice President. At other points, that will be sitting the other chairs. Here are the Speaker's members of the United States. The Supreme Court, they are not walking in. This is a tradition that's always interesting to see how many of the nine Supreme Court justices, the Chief Justice, there you see John Roberts right there, how many actually come to hear the President of the United States to deliver his State of the Union address and his State of the Union address bride. As we wait for the President of the United States to enter the House chamber only a few moments from now, let's take a quick look at what's going on, set the scene. You just saw the Supreme Court justices
of the United States. They have been introduced earlier. Members of the diplomatic corps, they were brought in. Members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they were there. You'll see the cabinet members about to be coming in. Right in the middle of your screen, you see the Vice President of the United States. He is the President of the Senate. That's why he's there, together with the House Speaker, John Boehner. All of this happening on a very, very important night for the President. He's got to make his case, a strong case, on lots of domestic issues as well as international issues. We want to welcome our viewers in the United States and around the world to our continuing coverage of the President's State of the Union address. I'm Wolf Blitzer in Washington. They are about to introduce the First Lady. There she is. This First Lady is sitting the Vice President, that's Dr. Joe Biden, the fifth, just saw that. They've got their own special guests who are in the gallery together with them. Each one has an important story, and the President will outline some of those stories in the State of the Union address. The members of the House and the Senate, they are obviously excited to see the First Lady. There she is, right there, waving the members of the House and the Senate. And there you see some of the members of the House who've been waiting for a long time on this critically important aisle seats, because they won't have an opportunity to shake the President's hand once he's introduced. So they've already introduced. I'm not supposed to be Assistant
Mr.
Sergeant of Arms.
The President's Cabinet.
There she is, Dr. Kathleen Joyce. She's the Assistant Sergeant of Arms. And you see John Kerry, the Secretary of State. He's the first member of the Cabinet who's coming in, followed by Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary there. Chuck Hagel, this is the first time Chuck Hagel will be inside the chamber. He used to be a senator. So he knows this situation very, very closely. But there's John Kerry, Secretary of State, is the dean of all of the cabinet members. There's Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States. Jake, you're right outside. You saw, did you see the actual cabinet members go right past you as almost everyone else did?
Yeah, that's right. The cabinet walked by here along with Vice President Biden and the Senate Majority Leader walking in. Interesting to note which Supreme Court justices did not come this evening. Wolf, we saw, I believe, six of them come in, but the conservative bloc, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas, are not in attendance. Interesting because we have seen Alito at previous State of the Unions. In fact, there was that famous moment where the President was criticizing the Supreme Court decision during one of his joint addresses to Congress, and Alito was seen, shall we say, disagreeing with what the President was saying. Alito is choosing not to attend this evening.
It's interesting. Once the President, the Cabinet is inside and they're all near their seats, then Paul Irving, the House Sergeant at Arms, he will announce those very, very powerful, familiar words, Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States. And then, of course, the President will walk in to strong applause. And what we're going to do, Jake, I want to make sure that we have a microphone in there. I want to hear what some of these members, some of these senators, congressmen say to the President as he's walking in. It's always interesting to hear some of the exchanges, and we'll presumably be able to do that as well. So the cabinet secretaries are taking their time walking in. You see in the middle of the screen, Tom Wolczek right there, the Secretary of Agriculture, Eddie Pritzker, the new Secretary of Commerce, right behind him. It's always one of those events that everyone is there, but there's one cabinet secretary who is not there, they always keep at least one member of the cabinet away. The Secretary of Energy in this particular case, he's there. So you see what's going on. We do think, Jake, that the President will defend the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as you see the First Lady with some of her special guests who will be introduced in the course of this event. Saw Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health. She was just inside as well. There she is, right there. Jake?
That's right. You see the Agriculture Secretary, Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Labor, and Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. She's had a rough 2013 with the rollout of Obamacare. There is the Secretary of the Department of Education, Ari Duncan, came with the President from Chicago, where he was in charge of Chicago schools. James Perling, who will be leaving the White House soon, the Director of the National Economic Council, John Donovan, is with Housing and Urban Development. There's Kathleen Steele.
During the last year of the Bush administration, as you might remember, Jake, Kathleen Sebelius was governor of Kansas. She delivered a Democratic response, to the Republican president address, the State of the Union address. She's under different circumstances, right now. Really interesting. John King and Gloria Borger. So you hear how much the president actually talks about the Affordable Care Act, as we see Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz standing by talking amongst themselves.
I see two critics of it right there, Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, one of the freshman Republican senators, Wolf already beginning to lay the groundwork for a possible 2016 presidential campaign based largely on his opposition to Obamacare. But that's part of a bigger debate, and the president will address it tonight. It's been a debate we've been having essentially for the past 24 years, having since the founding of the Republic, but since the Republican big win in the midterm of the Clinton years, about the size, the role, the scope of government, which is why we have such an evenly divided government. That has been the big fight. And when the president talks about the economic steps he's taking and health care, that is health care especially the past couple of years has been a defining fight over the size, the role, the scope of government.
And I wouldn't expect the president at all to back away from Obamacare. It's his signature legislative achievement. He's going to say that we fixed the problems with it, and he's going to sort of report to the American public about where Obamacare is, and he's going to say, look, if we need to continue to fix it, we're going to continue to fix it, but we're not going to go back. We're going to stay with it, which, by the way, is where the American public is. They're still very wary of it. They don't like it, but they don't want to undo what's been done.
I saw Susan Weiss, the President's National Security Advisor. She's there as well. A lot of the senior staff of the President, Dennis McDonough, there he is, the White House Chief of Staff, a former Deputy National Security Advisor to the President. So they come as well, in addition to members of the Cabinet, as you see the Vice President and the Speaker of the House. You know, it's interesting. I think, John and Gloria, it's been since the government shutdown in early October, this will be the first time the President and the Speaker actually get together face-to-face. They may have spoken on the phone, but I think this is going to be the first time in about 3 months or so, if not longer, that they're actually going to have a little directed counter, shall we say.
And you make an interesting point about it. If the president wants this to be a year of action, a year of progress, he's going to have to develop a relationship with the speaker. Now, remember, the speaker had his own internal problems during the government shutdown when he disagreed with the strategy of his most conservative members, but then essentially let them go forward. Now, if you talk to people around John Boehner, they believe he is at the strongest point of his speakership in the sense that he let those guys do their strategy. They failed. They took the blame for it. So he believes he has a longer leash, if you will, within his own caucus. It'll be interesting to see if he's willing in this election year, when it's all about base politics, how often is John Boehner willing to sit down with Barack Obama and vice versa and
okay.
do business.
And, Tommy, they have something in common, because the speaker can't control his base, and the president has had problems with his own base. Every time he talks about entitlement reform or getting the deficit under control or reforming Medicare, he's got a lot of problems with the base of his own party. And I don't think you're going to hear a lot about that in his speech this evening, because we're looking towards the 2014 elections, where he wants his base to be inspired and not angry at Democrats.
We're only probably seconds away. Here's the speaker acknowledging the president is going to be introduced. So let's listen to Paul Irving, the House Sergeant at Arms, makes the announcement. He's about to make the announcement, introducing the president. We're told the president is there at the door, but you saw the speaker nodding, giving the signal, go ahead, bring him in. So as you see Senator Joe Manchin there in the middle of the screen from West Virginia. We'll be hearing from the president. There he is. Let's just listen in as we get ready. The photographers are going in. The president is about to be introduced. He will walk in, and he'll be escorted, as you see, you'll see, with the members of the House and the Senate. There's a special escort committee.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
More than half. And for the first time,
For the first time in over a decade, business leaders around the world have declared that China is no longer the world's number one place to invest. America is. That's why I believe this can be a breakthrough year for America. After 5 years of grit and determined effort, the United States is better positioned for the 21st century than any other nation on earth. The question for everyone in this chamber, running through every decision we make this year, is whether we are going to help or hinder this progress. For several years now, this town has been consumed by a rancorous argument over the proper size of the federal government. It's an important debate, one that dates back to our very founding. But when that debate prevents us from carrying out even the most basic functions of our democracy, when our differences shut down government, or threaten the full faith and credit of the United States, then we are not doing right by the American people. As president, I'm committed to making Washington work better and rebuilding the trust of the people who sent us here. And I believe most of you are too. Last month, thanks to the work of Democrats and Republicans, Congress finally produced a budget that undoes some of last year's severe cuts to priorities like education. Nobody got everything they wanted. We can still do more to invest in this country's future while bringing down our deficit in a balanced way. But the budget compromise should leave us freer to focus on creating new jobs, not creating new crises. And in the coming months, let's see where else we can make progress together. Let's make this a year of action. That's what most Americans want. For all of us in this chamber to focus on their lives, their hopes, their aspirations. What I believe unites the people of this nation, regardless of race or region or party, young or old, rich or poor, is the simple, profound belief in opportunity for all. The notion that if you work hard and take responsibility, you can get ahead in America. Let's face it, that belief has suffered some serious blows. Over more than three decades, even before the Great Recession hit, massive shifts in technology and global competition had eliminated a lot of good middle-class jobs and weakened the economic foundations that families depend on. Today, after 4 years of economic growth, corporate profits and stock prices have rarely been higher, and those at the top have never done better. But average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled. The cold hard fact is that even in the midst of recovery, too many Americans are working more than ever just to get by, let alone to get ahead. And too many still aren't working at all. So our job is to reverse these trends. It won't happen right away, and we won't agree on everything. What I offer tonight is a set of concrete, practical proposals to speed up growth, strengthen the middle class, and build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class. Some require congressional action, and I'm eager to work with all of you. But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do. As usual, our First Lady sets a good example. Michelle Michelle's Let's Move partnership with schools, businesses, local leaders has helped bring down childhood obesity rates for the first time in 30 years. And that's an achievement that will improve lives and reduce health care costs for decades to come. The Joining Forces Alliance that Michelle and Jill Biden launched has already encouraged employers to hire or train nearly 400,000 veterans and military spouses. Taking a page from that playbook, the White House just organized a College Opportunity Summit where already 150 universities, businesses, nonprofits have made concrete commitments to reduce inequality and access to higher education and to help every hardworking kid go to college and succeed when they get to campus. And across the country, we're partnering with mayors, governors, and state legislatures on issues from homelessness to marriage equality. The point is, there are millions of Americans outside of Washington who are tired of stale political arguments and are moving this country forward. They believe, and I believe, that here in America, our success should depend not on accident of birth, but the strength of our work ethic and the scope of our dreams. That's what drew our forebears here. That's how the daughter of a factory worker is CEO of America's largest automaker. How the son of the barkeep is Speaker of the House. How the son of a single mom can be president of the greatest nation on earth. Well, opportunity is who we are. And the defining project of our generation must be to restore that promise. We know where to start. The best measure of opportunity is access to a good job. With the economy picking up speed, companies say they intend to hire more people this year. And over half of big manufacturers say they're thinking of insourcing jobs from abroad. Vision easier for more companies. Both Democrats and Republicans have argued that our tax code is riddled with wasteful, complicated loopholes that punish businesses investing here and reward companies that keep profits abroad. Let's flip that equation. Let's work together to close those loopholes and those incentives to ship jobs overseas and lower tax rates for businesses that create jobs right here at home. Moreover, we can take the money we save from this transition to tax reform to create jobs, rebuilding our roads, upgrading our ports, unclogging our commutes, because in today's global economy, first-class jobs gravitate to first-class infrastructure. We'll need Congress to protect more than 3 million jobs by finishing transportation and waterways bills this summer. That can happen. But I'll act on my own to slash bureaucracy and streamline the permitting process for key projects so we can get more construction workers on the job as fast as possible. We also have the chance right now to beat other countries in the race for the next wave of high-tech manufacturing jobs. And my administration's launched two hubs for high-tech manufacturing in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Youngstown, Ohio, where we've connected businesses to research universities that can help America lead the world in advanced technologies. Tonight, I'm announcing we'll launch six more this year. Bipartisan bills in both houses could double the number of these hubs and the jobs they create. So get those bills to my desk. Put more Americans back to work. more to help the entrepreneurs and small business owners who create most new jobs in America. Over the past 5 years, my administration has made more loans to small business owners than any other. And when 98% of our exporters are small businesses, new trade partnerships with Europe, Asia-Pacific, will help them create even more jobs. We need to work together on tools like bipartisan trade promotion authority to protect our workers, protect our environment, and open new markets to new goods stamped made in the USA. China and Europe aren't standing on the sidelines. Neither should we. We know that the nation that goes all in on innovation today will own the global economy tomorrow. This is an edge America cannot surrender. Federally funded research helps feed the ideas and inventions behind Google and smartphones, and that's why Congress should undo the damage done by last year's cuts to basic research, so we can unleash the next great American discovery. Entire industries to be built based on vaccines that stay ahead of drug-resistant bacteria, or paper-thin material that's stronger than steel. And let's pass a patent reform bill that allows our businesses to stay focused on innovation, not costly and needless litigation. Now, one of the biggest factors in bringing more jobs back is our commitment to American energy. The all-the-above energy strategy I announced a few years ago is working, and today America is closer to energy independence than we have been in decades. One of the reasons why is natural gas. If extracted safely, it's the bridge fuel that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change. Businesses plan to invest almost $100 billion in new factories that use natural gas. I'll cut red tape to help states get those factories built and put folks to work. And this Congress can help by putting people to work building fueling stations that ship more cars and trucks from foreign oil to American natural gas. Meanwhile, my administration will keep working with the industry to sustain production and jobs growth while strengthening protection of our air, our water, our communities. And while we're at it, I'll use my authority to protect more of our pristine federal lands for future generations. It's not just oil and natural gas production that's booming. We're becoming a global leader in solar, too. Every 4 minutes, another American home or business goes solar. Every panel pounded into place by a worker whose job cannot be outsourced. Let's continue that progress with a smarter tax policy that stops giving $4 billion a year to fossil fuel industries that don't need it, so we can invest more in fuels of the future that do. And even as we've increased energy production, we've partnered with businesses, builders, and local communities to reduce the energy we consume. When we rescued our automakers, for example, we worked with them to set higher fuel efficiency standards for our cars. In the coming months, I'll build on that success by setting new standards for our trucks so we can keep driving down oil imports and what we pay at the pump. And taken together, our energy policy is creating jobs and leading to a cleaner, safer planet. Over the past 8 years, the United States has reduced our total carbon pollution more than any other nation on Earth. But we have to act with more urgency. because the changing climate is already harming Western communities struggling with drought and coastal cities dealing with floods. That's why I directed my administration to work with states, utilities, and others to set new standards on the amount of carbon pollution our power plants are allowed to dump into the air. The shift to a cleaner energy economy won't happen overnight, and it will require some tough choices along the way. But the debate is settled. Climate change is a fact. And when our children's children look us in the eye and ask if we did all we could to leave them a safer, more stable world with new sources of energy, I want us to be able to say, yes, we did. Finally, if we're serious about economic growth, it is time to heed the call of business leaders, labor leaders, faith leaders, law enforcement, and fix our broken immigration system. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have acted, and I know that members of both parties in the House want to do the same. Independent economists say immigration reform will grow our economy and shrink our deficits by almost $1 trillion in the next 2 decades. And for good reason. When people come here to fulfill their dreams, to study, invest, contribute to our culture, they make our country a more attractive place for businesses to locate and create jobs for everybody. So let's get immigration reform done this year. Let's get it done. The ideas I've outlined so far can speed up growth and create more jobs. But in this rapidly changing economy, we have to make sure that every American has the skills to fill those jobs. The good news is we know how to do it. 2 years ago, as the auto industry came roaring back, Andra Rush opened up a manufacturing firm in Detroit. She knew that Ford needed parts for the best-selling truck in America, and she knew how to make those parts. She just needed the workforce. So she dialed up what we call an American job center, places where folks can walk in to get the help or training they need to find a new job or a better job. She was flooded with new workers. And today, Detroit Manufacturing Systems has more than 700 employees. And what Andra and her employees experienced is how it should be for every employer and every job seeker. Tonight, I've asked Vice President Biden to lead an across-the-board reform of America's training programs to make sure they have one mission: train Americans with the skills employers need and match them to good jobs that need to be filled right now. More on-the-job training and more apprenticeships to set a young worker on an upward trajectory for life. It means connecting companies to community colleges that can help design training to fill their specific needs. If Congress wants to help, you can concentrate funding on proven programs that connect more ready-to-work Americans with ready-to-be-filled jobs. I'm also convinced we can help Americans return to the workforce faster by reforming unemployment insurance so that it's more effective in today's economy. But first, this Congress needs to restore the unemployment insurance you just let expire for 1.6 million people. Let me tell you why. Missy DeMars is a mother of two young boys. She'd been steadily employed since she was a teenager, put herself through college. She'd never collected unemployment benefits, but she'd been paying taxes. In May, she and her husband used their life savings to buy their first home. A week later, budget cut claimed the job she loved. Last month when their unemployment insurance was cut off, she sat down and wrote me a letter, the kind I get every day. We are the face of the unemployment crisis, she wrote. I'm not dependent on the government. Our country depends on people like us who build careers, contribute to society, care about our neighbors. I'm confident that in time I will find a job, I will pay my taxes, and we will raise our children in their own home in the community we love. Please give us this chance. Congress, give these hardworking, responsible Americans that chance. Give them that chance. They need our help right now, but more important, this country needs them in the game. That's why I've been asking CEOs to give more long-term unemployed workers a fair shot at new jobs, a new chance to support their families. And in fact, this week, many will come to the White House to make that commitment real. Tonight, I ask every business leader in America to join us and do the same, because we are stronger when America fields a full team. Of course, it's not enough to train today's workforce. We also have to prepare tomorrow's workforce by guaranteeing every child access to world-class education. But Stephen Rodriguez couldn't speak a word of English when he moved to New York City at age 9. But last month, thanks to the support of great teachers and an innovative tutoring program, he led a march of his classmates to a crowd of cheering parents and neighbors from their high school to the post office where they mailed off their college applications. And this son of a factory worker just found out he's going to college this fall. Years ago, we set out to change the odds for all our kids. We worked with lenders to reform student loans, and today more young people are earning college degrees than ever before. Race to the Top, with the help of governors from both parties, has helped states raise expectations and performance. Teachers and principals in schools from Tennessee to Washington, D.C. are making big strides in preparing students with the skills for the new economy. Problem solving, critical thinking, technology, engineering, math. Now, some of this change is hard. It requires everything from more challenging curriculums and more demanding parents to better support for teachers and new ways to measure how well our kids think, not how well they can fill in a bubble on a test. But it is worth it, and it is working. The problem is we're still not reaching enough kids. We're not reaching them in time, and that has to change. Research shows that one of the best investments we can make in a child's life is high-quality early education. Last year, I asked this Congress to help states make high-quality pre-K available to every four-year-old. And as a parent, as well as the president, I repeat that request tonight. But in the meantime, 30 states have raised pre-K funding on their own. They know we can't wait. So just as we worked with states to reform our schools, this year we'll invest in new partnerships with states and communities across the country in a race to the top for our youngest children. And as Congress decides what it's going to do, I'm going to pull together a coalition of elected officials, business leaders, and philanthropists willing to help more kids access the high-quality pre-K that they need. It is right for America. We need to get this done. Last year, I also pledged to connect 99% of our students to high-speed broadband over the next 4 years. Tonight I can announce that with the support of the FCC and companies like Apple, Microsoft, Sprint, and Verizon, we've got a down payment to start connecting more than 15,000 schools and 20 million students over the next 2 years without adding a dime to the deficit. We're working to redesign iSTEM with colleges and employers that offer the real-world education and hands-on training that can lead directly to a job and career. We're shaking up our system of higher education to give parents more information and colleges more incentive to offer better value, so that no middle-class kid is priced out of a college education. We're offering millions the opportunity to cap their monthly student loan payments to 10% of their income. And I want to work with Congress to see how we can help even more Americans who feel trapped by student loan debt. And I'm reaching out to some of America's leading foundations and corporations on a new initiative to help more young men of color facing especially tough odds to stay on track and reach their full potential. The bottom line is, Michelle and I want every child to have the same chance this country gave us. But we know our opportunity agenda won't be complete, and too many young people entering the workforce today will see the American dream as an empty promise, unless we also do more to make sure our economy honors the dignity of work and hard work pays off for every single American. Now today, women make up about half our workforce, but they still make 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. That is wrong. And in 2014, it's an embarrassment. Women deserve equal pay for equal work. She deserves to have a baby without sacrificing her job. A mother deserves a day off to care for a sick child or a sick parent without running into hardship. And you know what? A father does too. It is time to do away with workplace policies that belong in a Mad Men episode. This year, let's all come together, Congress, the White House, businesses from Wall Street to Main Street, to give every woman the opportunity she deserves, because I believe when women succeed, America succeeds. Now, women hold a majority of lower wage jobs, but they're not the only ones stifled by stagnant wages. Americans understand that some people will earn more money than others, and we don't resent those who, by virtue of their efforts, achieve incredible success. That's what America's all about. But Americans overwhelmingly agree that no one who works full-time should ever have to raise a family in poverty. So I asked this Congress to raise the minimum wage. Five states have passed laws to raise theirs. Many businesses have done it on their own. Nick Shute is here today with his boss, John Serrano. John's an owner of Punch Pizza in Minneapolis. And Nick helps make the dough. Only now he makes more of it. John just gave his employees a raise to $10 an hour, and that's a decision that has eased their financial stress and boosted their morale. Tonight I ask more of America's business leaders to follow John's lead. Do what you can to raise your employees' wages. It's good for the economy. It's good for America. Every mayor, governor, state legislator in America, I say, you don't have to wait for Congress to act. Americans will support you if you take this on. And as the chief executive, I intend to lead by example. Profitable corporations like Costco see higher wages as the smart way to boost productivity and reduce turnover. We should too. In the coming weeks, I will issue an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their federally funded employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour, because if you cook our troops' meals or wash their dishes, you should not have to live in poverty. Of course, to reach millions more, Congress does need to get on board. Today, the federal minimum wage is worth about 20% less than it was when Ronald Reagan first stood here. And Tom Harkin and George Miller have a bill to fix that by lifting the minimum wage to $10.10. It's easy to remember, 10-10. This will help families. It will give businesses customers with more money to spend. It does not involve any new bureaucratic program. So join the rest of the country. Say yes. Give America a raise. Give them a raise. There are other steps we can take to help families make ends meet. And few are more effective in reducing inequality and helping families pull themselves up through hard work than the Earned Income Tax Credit. Right now, it helps about half of all parents at some point. Think about that. It helps about half of all parents in America at some point in their lives. But I agree with Republicans like Senator Rubio that it doesn't do enough for single workers who don't have kids. So let's work together to strengthen the credit, reward work, help more Americans get ahead. Let's do more to help Americans save for retirement. Today, most workers don't have a pension. A Social Security check often isn't enough on its own. And while the stock market has doubled over the last 5 years, that doesn't help folks who don't have 401ks. That's why tomorrow I will direct the Treasury to create a new way for working Americans to start their own retirement savings. My IRA. It's a new savings bond that encourages folks to build a nest egg. IRA guarantees a decent return with no risk of losing what you put in. And if this Congress wants to help, work with me to fix an upside-down tax code that gives big tax breaks to help the wealthy save, but does little or nothing for middle-class Americans. Offer every American access to an automatic IRA on the job so they can save at work just like everybody in this chamber can. And since the most important investment many families make is their home, send me legislation that protects taxpayers from footing the bill for a housing crisis ever again and keeps the dream of home ownership alive for future generations. One last point on financial security. For decades, few things exposed hardworking families to economic hardship more than a broken health care system. And in case you haven't heard, we're in the process of fixing that. A pre-existing condition used to mean that someone like Amanda Shelley, a physician's assistant and single mom from Arizona, couldn't get health insurance. But on January 1st, she got covered. On January 3rd, she felt a sharp pain. On January 6th, she had emergency surgery. Just 1 week earlier, Amanda said, and that surgery would have meant bankruptcy. That's what health insurance reform is all about. The peace of mind that if misfortune strikes, you don't have to lose everything. Already, because of the Affordable Care Act, more than 3 million Americans under age 26 have gained coverage under their parents' plan. than 9 million Americans have signed up for private health insurance or Medicaid coverage. 9 million. And here's another number. Zero. Because of this law, no American, none, zero, can ever again be dropped or denied coverage for a pre-existing condition like asthma or back pain or cancer. No woman can ever be charged more just because she's a woman. And we did all this while adding years to Medicare's finances, keeping Medicare premiums flat, and lowering prescription costs for millions of seniors. Now, I do not expect to convince my Republican friends on the merits of this law. But I know that the American people are not interested in refighting old battles. So, again, if you have specific plans to cut costs, cover more people, increase choice, tell America what you do differently. Let's see if the numbers add up. But let's not have another 40-something vote to repeal a law that's already helping millions of Americans like Amanda. We all owe it to the American people to say what we're for, not just what we're against. And if you want to know the real impact this law has had, just talk to Governor Steve Beshear of Kentucky, who's here tonight. Now, Kentucky is not the most liberal part of the country. That's not where I got my highest vote totals. But he's like a man possessed when it comes to covering his Commonwealth's families. There are neighbors and our friends, he said. The people we shop and go to church with. Farmers out on the tractor. Grocery clerks. The people who go to work every morning praying they don't get sick. No one deserves to live that way. Steve's right. That's why tonight I ask every American who knows someone without health insurance to help them get covered by March 31st. Help them get covered. Moms, get on your kids and sign up. Kids, call your mom and walk her through the application. They'll give her some peace of mind, and plus she'll appreciate hearing from you. After all, that's the spirit that has always moved this nation forward. It's the spirit of citizenship. The recognition that through hard work and responsibility, we can pursue our individual dreams but still come together as one American family to make sure the next generation can pursue its dreams as well. Citizenship means standing up for everyone's right to vote. Last year, part of the Voting Rights Act was weakened, but conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats are working together to strengthen it. And the bipartisan commission I appointed, chaired by my campaign lawyer and Governor Romney's campaign lawyer, came together and have offered reforms so that no one has to wait more than a half hour to vote. Let's support these efforts. It should be the power of our vote, not the size of our bank account, that drives our democracy. Citizenship means standing up for the lives that gun violence steals from us each day. I've seen the courage of parents, students, pastors, police officers all over this country who say, we are not afraid. And I intend to keep trying, with or without Congress, to help stop more tragedies from visiting innocent Americans in our movie theaters and our shopping malls or schools like Sandy Hook. This is just a man, a sense of common purpose. Participation in the hard work of self-government. An obligation to serve our communities. And I know this chamber agrees that few Americans give more to their country than our diplomats and the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Because of the extraordinary troops and civilians who risk and lay down their lives to keep us free, the United States is more secure. When I took office, nearly 180,000 Americans were serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, all our troops are out of Iraq. More than 60,000 of our troops have already come home from Afghanistan. With Afghan forces now in the lead for their own security, our troops have moved to a support role. Together with our allies, we will complete our mission there by the end of this year, and America's longest war will finally be over. After 2014, we will support a unified Afghanistan as it takes responsibility for its own future. If the Afghan government signs a security agreement that we have negotiated, a small force of Americans could remain in Afghanistan with NATO allies to carry out two narrow missions, training and assisting Afghan forces and counterterrorism operations to pursue any remnants of al-Qaeda. But while our relationship with Afghanistan will change, one thing will not. Our resolve that terrorists do not launch attacks against our country. The fact is, that danger remains. While we've put al-Qaeda's core leadership on a path to defeat, the threat has evolved as al-Qaeda affiliates and other extremists take root in different parts of the world. In Yemen, Somalia, Iraq, Mali, we have to keep working with partners to disrupt and disable those networks. In Syria, we'll support the opposition that rejects the agenda of terrorist networks. Here at home, we'll keep strengthening our defense and combat new threats like cyber attacks. And as we reform our defense budget, we will have to keep faith with our men and women in uniform and invest in the capabilities they need to feed in future missions. We have to remain vigilant. But I strongly believe our leadership and our security cannot depend on our outstanding military alone. As Commander-in-Chief, I have used force when needed to protect the American people. And I will never hesitate to do so as long as I hold this office. But I will not send our troops in harm's way unless it is truly necessary, nor will I allow our sons and daughters to be mired in open-ended conflicts. We must fight the battles that need to be fought, not those that terrorists prefer from us. Large-scale deployments that drain our strength and may ultimately feed extremism. So even as we actively and aggressively pursue terrorist networks through more targeted efforts by building the capacity of our foreign partners. America must move off a permanent war footing. That's why I've imposed prudent limits on the use of drones. But we will not be safer if people abroad believe we strike within their countries without regard for the consequence. That's why, working with this Congress, I will reform our surveillance programs, because the vital work of our intelligence community depends on public confidence here and abroad. The privacy of ordinary people is not being violated. With the Afghan war ending, this needs to be the year Congress lifts the remaining restrictions on detainee transfers and we close the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Because we counter terrorism not just through intelligence and military action, but by remaining true to our constitutional ideals and setting an example for the rest of the world. You see, in a world of complex threats, our security, our leadership, depends on all elements of our power, including strong and principled diplomacy. American diplomacy has rallied more than 50 countries to prevent nuclear materials from falling into the wrong hands and allowed us to reduce our own reliance on Cold War stockpiles. American diplomacy, backed by the threat of force, is why serious chemical weapons are being eliminated. And we will continue to work with the international community to usher in the future the Syrian people deserve, a future free of dictatorship, terror, and fear. As we speak, American diplomacy is supporting Israelis and Palestinians as they engage in the difficult but necessary talks to end the conflict there, to achieve dignity and an independent state for Palestinians, and lasting peace and security for the state of Israel, a Jewish state that knows America will always be at their side. And it is American diplomacy, backed by pressure, that has halted the progress of Iran's nuclear program and rolled back parts of that program for the very first time in a decade. As we gather here tonight, Iran has begun to eliminate its stockpile of higher levels of enriched uranium. It's not installing advanced centrifuges. Unprecedented inspections help the world verify every day that Iran is not building a bomb. And with our allies and partners, we're engaged in negotiations to see if we can peacefully achieve a goal we all share, preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. These negotiations will be difficult. They may not succeed. We are clear-eyed about Iran's support for terrorist organizations like Hezbollah, which threatens our allies. And we're clear about the mistrust between our nations, mistrust that cannot be wished away. But these negotiations don't rely on trust. Any long-term deal we agree to must be based on verifiable action that convinces us and the international community that Iran is not building a nuclear bomb. If John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan could negotiate with the Soviet Union, then surely a strong and confident America can negotiate with less powerful adversaries today. So we put in place help make this opportunity possible. But let me be clear. If this Congress sends me a new sanctions bill now that threatens to derail these talks, I will veto it. For the sake of our national security, we must give diplomacy a chance to succeed. If Iran's leaders do not seize this opportunity, then I will be the first to call for more sanctions and stand ready to exercise all options to make sure Iran does not build a nuclear weapon. But if Iran's leaders do seize the chance, and we'll know soon enough, then Iran could take an important step to rejoin the community of nations, and we will have resolved one of the leading security challenges of our time without the risks of war. And finally, let's remember that our leadership is defined not just by our defense against threats, but by the enormous opportunities to do good and promote understanding around the globe, to forge greater cooperation, to expand new markets, to free people from fear and want. And no one is better positioned to take advantage of those opportunities than America. Our alliance with Europe remains the strongest.